Hi, and welcome to Between the Rows. I'll be your host this week, Dave Bedard. This week we're talking about reducing food waste, and for that we're taking you to British Columbia's wine country, where a company has several new uses for what's left over after the grapes have been crushed. And among those uses, it's helping to improve the flavor profile of all that plant-based protein coming to market.
What we're doing is we're using the polyphenols, the tannins, in our product to basically act as a palate cleanser.
Also, if you've ever done a SWOT analysis for your farm business, you know, strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats, you'll want to hear this interview about a new report coming out regarding current and emerging threats for all users of Canada's plant resources, which of course includes you.
And very often we've seen, certainly in Western Canada, droughts, heat domes, and these types of things. It puts stresses onto the system, and the impact then perhaps of the pest can be even more severe.
All that's coming up on Between the Rows after this.
I've been farming my whole life, and the one thing you can always count on is change. And now there's a new generation of inoculants from Lalemann Plant Care. New engineered granules and Lalfix spherical for pulses and soybeans that provide improved handling and accurate metering. New Rhizobium and Lalfix Pro Yield that deliver improved nitrogen fixation and iron uptake in soybeans. I've seen a lot of change. But this Lalemann company, well, this changes everything. Contact your Lalemann sales representative today.
Now, last week, Federal Ag Minister Marie-Claude Bibeau announced the list of the 18 semifinalists for the Food Waste Reduction Challenge. That's an initiative meant to support what they described as high-impact solutions to food waste in Canada. In this round, each of those 18 semifinalists gets $100,000 toward putting together actual existing prototypes of their respective technologies over the next 8 months and reporting back on those prototypes' effectiveness. From there, six finalists get picked to receive up to $450,000 each, and from there, two finalists will win grand prizes of up to $1 million. Today we're going to speak with one of those semi-finalists working on a technology very near and dear to my heart personally as a consumer of Canadian wine. Bill Brody is president of Wine Crush Technologies at Summerland in BC's Okanagan Valley. Mr. Brody, hi, and welcome to Between the Rows.
Well, thank you very much for having us join you today. We're really looking forward to telling you all about what we're up to and our pleasure being selected by Ag Canada and the Impact Canada folks.
Mm-hmm. And congratulations for making the cut, by the way. Now, mm-hmm. you've actually been in this line of work for a while now, and you've personally been involved in other startup companies before as well. From your perspective, how unusual is this contest model sort of compared to the typical process for lining up grants or investors?
Well, it's this is not the first time we've participated in a model like this, but this one being a three-tiered opportunity is certainly unique. I think it's great in that there's funds involved and there's recognition involved, and for us that's there's some synergy there. It's exciting to get the recognition, and what's exciting about the funding is it drives out a lot of innovators that might not have come forward if there wasn't a significant amount of funding available from the program. Mm-hmm. And really exciting and gratifying to know that of the, I think there were roughly 300 applicants, that we were one of 18 chosen to go to the first round of the funding.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of amazing too. I mean, you've been in business for a few years now with this company, and along comes this national level competition that seems to be, yeah, you know, sort of right in your wheelhouse.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, we've been in business for just under 6 years now. Mm-hmm. The company started with an event that was sort of the aha moment. I retired to the Okanagan but just over 6 years ago, and as most of you know, it's a lovely place to live, and I was out riding my bicycle in Summerland between wineries and noticed a mother bear and her two cubs devouring this pile of derivatives from the winery, basically a pile of pumice. And that was the beginning of the aha moment. I realized here's a material that, you know, that's quite flavorful when you use it in food. And what I found out from the gentleman who's now our wine scientist, Gary Strawn, is that it was the best thing for these bears to be eating. It, it's full of polyphenols, full of anthocyanins, and just before Mama Bear is about to crawl into a cave to hibernate in the cold, mildewy cave, she's eating the best thing in the world for her, just full of antioxidants. That was the really the aha moment. Here's something that's very nutritious, very flavorful, and it's basically dumped at the end of the vineyard because nobody wants to deal with it. You know, having been involved in startups before, I've been going, okay, well, there's got to be a business here. We've taken a long way. Brought on board a great team, our CEO, Kirk Moore, and our CFO, Kirsten Swartz. I've been running with the office, which has given me time to focus on the creative side of the business. Go ahead.
Well, we spoke briefly the other day about the very specific food waste issue involved here. Just the idea that this byproduct is dumped at the end of the vineyard or just left for compost. You know, how big of an issue is this for the wine industry generally?
It is probably one of the biggest hidden food waste situations in the world. Grapes are the third largest fruit crop in the world after watermelon and bananas. Approximately the vast majority of it is pressed for wine or grape juice, over 80% of it. And about one third of the grape is thrown away at that point. It represents about 15 megatons of edible derivatives or wasted food, which is enough to feed the world for at least a day each year in terms of calories and nutrition. Because it is thrown away typically to compost or thrown into landfills, it generates about 50 million tons of greenhouse gases. And just to put that in perspective, the Alberta oil sands generate about 70 million per year. So this is a big source of methane pollution that we can convert into a very nutritious food product.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm assuming there are other sources out there for the ingredients that you folks are processing from these byproducts. Now, if I'm a processor and I'm looking for these sorts of things, what's in it for me to go with grape biomass instead of some other source?
Yeah, well, grapes. I think everybody's heard about, drink red wine for your health. What isn't realized is that 70-80% of all the nutrients in a red grape, red wine grapes, are in the derivative. So when we process these derivatives, it's just amassed in polyphenols, very high iron content, calcium, potassium. So it's a very, very nutritious source of food. And one of the things about it that we've discovered is a way to cure it or mature it into an acidified paste. And as a result of that, it can be used in a number of food products to dramatically reduce salt levels. We're working with a number of plant-based protein companies, both the producers of plant-based protein and retail product manufacturers.
Mm-hmm. That's a very hot topic right now, isn't it?
Yeah. And we have there are plant-based meats that are on shelf right now where they have been able to lower the sodium in the in their burgers by up to 80% as a result of adding a small percentage of our product to their formula. In addition, you can use our product as a way to extend shelf life. You can also use it as a way to lower sugar content. And it also allows you to cut back on maybe some of the spicing in a product because it will enhance the flavor of spicing. And the secret behind this is that unlike other food products that, especially in the salt reduction area, we're not disguising or we're not using umami as a way to substitute for salt. What we're doing is we're using the polyphenols, the tannins, in our product to basically act as a palate cleanser. We clean away the protein from your tongue, the saliva from your tongue, and clean out the pellicles in your salt receptors. So salt tastes way saltier in a product where you use our product, our ingredient.
So it's a good pairing with these products then, so to speak.
Yeah. I mean, if you're looking for the lower salt, which every manufacturer is looking for, this is a really nice, clean, natural way to do it.
Now, obviously, you've been working with this technology for a while now, and you've been working on your process for a while now. What's the new technology that you're developing using the food waste challenge funding?
Okay, well, one of the key things we've discovered, I should step back and say that the wine industry has been looking for ways to use this product in food, and conventionally, people have always said, take it, dry it out, make it into a powder or flour, and then add it to the food. And we did that originally. And what we found was the product, although there was a good taste to the product, there was this really harsh aftertaste from the tannin. So what we discovered was by putting together a secret cocktail of microbes, we could ferment the pumice into something that didn't have this harsh aftertaste. It's actually quite a pleasant aftertaste now as a result of our process. To do that, we need to have the material go into a bioreactor. And rather than trying to centralize this by collecting all of the pumice from the wineries, bring it to a central location, and build massive bioreactors to handle it, we thought a better way to do it, and a way in which wineries could actually earn income, would be to develop a portable and transportable bioreactor in which they could easily load the pressings from their press very quickly in a way that's no more difficult than the current way they dispose of it. That we needed a bioreactor that was completely sealed so that you don't have any cross-contamination between our fermentation process and the wine fermentation process. And to make sure that's the case, we want to make sure that our bioreactors would work outdoors so that we don't have to take it inside the winery. So we basically have a way for wineries to take their material, put it in our bioreactor, add the secret sauce or the secret microbes to it, seal it up and leave it outside, potentially even just leave it between the vineyards. You can stack them up in between vineyard rows. And they just leave them for a period of time until they finish their ferment. When they get to a finished state, we come collect them, and we pay for the successfully fermented product, and we take it to our facility where we blend it. We macerate it into something that's more like a tomato paste in texture, and pasteurize it. And then we package it in bulk containers, either barrels or IBC totes, for shipment to food processors.
That doesn't sound like it'd be very difficult for a winery to sort of bring that system into the sort of the flow of its own day-to-day business.
Or even
just to set it up at the wherever you've got the pile there.
Yeah. Well, and that's the case. I mean, I'm sure you know, as my grandpa used to say, who, you know, had a ranch, a homestead, and, he said, the old line is, never trying to get a farmer to do something like trying to get a pig to sing. It's a waste of time and it bothers a pig. Well, try to do that during harvest, and you're just going to get everybody really mad. And that's the challenge we have. We need to basically the period in which the winemakers are crushing the wine is just like harvest at a farm. It's their harvest period. So mm-hmm. everything, they've hired not quite enough people to pull it off with. They're under the gun to get the product, to a state where they can use it. And the last thing they want to worry about is, what do I do with the stuff I typically take to the waste pile? And as you can probably guess, we have to have something that is real easy to work with, that doesn't take any time, doesn't take any doesn't divert from other management issues. And that's why this funding really will help. The first stage of the funding will go around the design of the container and making sure that it meets the needs of the winemaker and the winery, that it, doesn't, it works. And then hopefully the next stage will be about, getting mass adoption by the wineries. And that's why we're hoping we'll make it to the next round, because, this is 20% technology and 80% sociology. Mm-hmm. Training the winemakers, the cellar master, the cellar hands-on, this process is going to be a critical part of making it a success. And, I think once, and it'll be like all new things, as soon as, wineries are seeing revenue from it, and they realize, and unlike wine, there's no whiskey tax on it, that we're hoping that will have a snowball effect and that we'll readily get adoption in the industry.
Mm-hmm. Now, if the product from these individual wineries needs to come back to your plant then for final processing, is it safe for me to assume that exporting this technology elsewhere, like to the Niagara region or to to Europe or Australia or South Africa or what have you? Now, would that mean building separate wine crush technologies plants in those regions as well?
Yeah, I think the optimal plan would be, is about, you want to be within an hour of the material. 45 minutes to an hour. And there's many wine regions out there that you could do this in. But because most of the capital and most of the real estate is actually at the winery, it doesn't require a massive plant and warehouse to finish the product. So it's, again, optimize to the wineries being a major participant and getting a significant revenue stream from it. Mm-hmm. And we are there is interest around the world in what we're doing. We do hold we hold multiple patents pending in this area. Once we get it working in the Okanagan, we can certainly take what we're doing here to Niagara, to Finger Lakes, to California, to Washington State, Australia, South America, Europe, mm-hmm. all of which have shown some interest already in what we're doing.
And I imagine that as far as interest, we've talked before on the show about the Protein Industries Canada Supercluster and the work they're doing in developing plant-based protein. Usually when I think of, plant-based proteins, I'm thinking like, peas, lentils, that kind of thing. But, grapes isn't the first crop that comes to mind. But I gather the Protein Supercluster is already interested in what you're doing as well.
Yes, we are in fact involved in two PIC projects, one with Top Tier, and we're jointly developing a plant-based Wagyu steak and some pork products with them. And it does involve the Saskatchewan Development Center, as well as ourselves and Top Tier. Another project, again, this is with, and I forget their new names, it's Blue Heron Cheese.
Oh, yes.
And Save On Foods. Again, we're involved, participating with the Saskatchewan Food Dev in this. And this is to develop a use our product to extend the shelf life of plant-based cheese. Again, exciting area. One of the reasons that our product is really popular in plant-based protein, especially when it comes to lentils, one of the challenges around around lentils in plant-based protein is that odor and aftertaste associated with it. And what we've discovered is that by adding a bit of our product to the lentil, we basically that odor and aftertaste. We basically coat the lentils with polyphenols. Polyphenols tend to bind to proteins, and by doing it to the lentil protein, it actually masks those flavors, so you don't get that kind of pea taste that you don't really notice that during the chew, but it comes up. You kind of notice it afterwards. And I think that's going to be a big reason why we're going to be a big part of the PIC world in the future.
Mm-hmm. Well, it certainly sounds like an exciting process, and we'll be very interested to see what happens as the food waste challenge goes forward. What's your deadline, do you know, to have your prototype up and ready for the next stage?
Well, we really need to have the for the next stage, we need to be done by the fall. But more importantly, we probably need to have at least one or two iterations before then. It's very important that we work with the winemaker and the cellar masters on this, making sure they're happy. We've got our ideas on what we think they want, but it's definitely, they are the number one customer for this product. And if they're happy, I think we'll be very successful with it.
Mm-hmm. And it'll certainly be interesting to see how this goes. Thank you very much for your time today. This will be very interesting to watch as we head into the fall.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Bill Brody is the president and founder of Wine Crush Technologies. For more information on their products, you can visit their website at www.winecrush.ca. You're listening to Between the Rows. I'm your host this week, Dave Bedard. A shock to anyone that the biodiversity map of Canada is changing. It's affecting not only what crops we can grow and where, and how many new and different insects and diseases can follow along behind them. Well, why is this? Well, climate change, of course, but also changes in land use, changes in farming practices, even changes in how much we travel and our trade flow with other countries. UBC Okanagan plant scientist and biology professor Dr. Deborah Buzzard has headed up a multidisciplinary panel, including representation from the farming and indigenous communities, as well as science and academia. The panel has a new report just out via the Council of Canadian Academies and commissioned by the Canadian Food Inspection Agency. It looks at both the well-known and up-and-coming risk to plant health, the risk management practices available, and whether Canada's RMPs are up to the job. You're going to hear her in conversation here with Glacier Farm Media's VP Content, Laura Rance. Let's have a listen.
The reality is that the government asked for this report, and the lead agency was the Canadian Food Inspection Agency, which is tasked with taking care of our food safety, but also taking care of plant health in Canada across ecosystems, agriculture, forestry, wild ecosystems. And they recognize that the increasing pace of climate change, the increasing transportation of people and goods across borders, our involvement in the global food system means that we're more and more challenged about keeping our ecosystems healthy, our plant production in agriculture healthy, and looking at what those risks are facing a changing climate and, as I say, ever-increasing transportation and movement of goods and people.
Are any of the risks that you've identified unique to Canada?
You know, we do have a risk in the north where we think of as global warming is happening, that plant ranges and animal ranges are moving further north in the northern hemisphere. And of course, plants that are native and rare and endangered in Canada's north, they have nowhere to go. So that is perhaps a unique to very northern kinds of countries. But the other risks of, you know, ever-evolving pests, diseases, and the need for farmers to be able to adapt quickly, those are shared around the world.
It's interesting. The panel separated the risks to plant health into three broad categories, the environmental, pests, and governments. But you also identified some exacerbating factors that can converge to increase the level of or degree of threat in any of those categories. Can you, you know, it's referred to as a complex web of risks. And I just wondered if you could give me a couple of examples of how you see that playing out.
We know, for example, that, you know, a healthy plant requires healthy soil. And so when we have changing environmental conditions, and very often we've seen, certainly in Western Canada, droughts, heat domes, and these types of things, it puts stresses onto the system. And the impact then perhaps of a pest can be even more severe. And if we think in the forestry context of mountain pine beetle, which is now moving across the country, the original threat is the pest. But the changing climate means that it has the capacity to move into areas where we haven't seen it before. So that's what we mean by a multiplying effect of different stressors coming in.
What are the implications of this for agriculture, for farmers and the agricultural sector in particular?
Well, you know, I think, I mean, all farmers live with risk. You know, we know every day it's climate, it's price, it's the system, it's the availability of varieties and so on. And so what I think it means is probably more awareness. And I would hope that the agriculture sector would see that there's real value of the sector engaging with the government agencies, the international agencies, to make sure that we are developing the tools that we need to address the risks. And understanding, of course, that risk, you know, we talk about the need for various different approaches to mitigating and reducing risk. And I think for farmers, that means, you know, thinking and planning. And I know this is what farmers are doing already, but we need the tools and we need to have, you know, the redundancy so that, you know, in a dry season, we perhaps pick a different variety of a crop that we're going to grow, one that has higher drought resistance. We may want to ensure that we have more diversity in our production system so that if something is maybe not going to be so successful, we have other crops that we can rely on as well. But just to be prepared and to keep pushing for the kinds of federal and provincial investments that we need to make sure that we're ready. That we can deal with these things. And there's many ways that I think we need to do that.
Well, when you think of it, farmers are kind of on the front lines of both having to adapt to the climate, but also they're very much could be part of the solution in terms of mitigating through some of the approaches that they're going to take.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that, you know, what we've seen, I mean, just thinking of the way that farmers, you know, large scale field cropping farmers have moved to no-till and the impact that's had on soil carbon and the health of the soil. And at the same time, the benefits the farmers are reaping from seeing how much better water retention is. So it's a virtuous circle of enabling them to be more resilient in the face of drought and actually to prepare and improve the farm to be more resilient in the future.
You mentioned the word redundancy. We need to have some redundancy built in. And I came across that word frequently in the report, especially in the context of biodiversity. And I think we're cultured to think of redundancy as a sign of inefficiency. And we've become focused in agriculture and maybe keeping the number of species in our fields to a minimum. And I'm just wondering how this report may change how we think about those things in suggesting that we need more biodiversity and we need redundancy in our systems.
Yes. You know, I think we think about this and, you know, there's redundancy, for example, in having a choice of different varieties of seeds of the crop that you're intending to grow. That's a form of redundancy. I can grow variety A or B or C, depending on what the situation is. To have a choice about alternative crops, new crops, perhaps, to consider as part of a healthy rotation system on a farm. To be able to, well, I think farmers very well understand that we can't rely on a single pesticide or a single approach to pest or disease control because we know that resistance happens. And so we want to have a lot of tools in our toolbox to deal with those kinds of threats. And, you know, it's I think it's a normal part of preparedness. You know, we've all learned a lot, I think, from COVID that, you know, we're going to have to sometimes be resilient and handle things that we wouldn't expect. And so, you know, it's good to have some stored food in the larder, and it's good to have a choice about how you're going to approach dealing with something. But I think, you know, I want to be clear, we're not suggesting that every farm has to be a patchwork of multi-variety crops and so on. Thinking about, you know, how you manage farms, large-scale farms, to ensure that you take the care of the soil, because that is the resource, that's the real value of the farm. You know, cover crops in the winter, other types of rotations, no-till, all of these are ways of thinking about improving the soil as that basic resource for the future of the farm. And I think Canadian farmers have, you know, we've done that for a long time, and we can see the benefits when farmers move to those kinds of approaches.
This report really points to a focus on continuing innovation. I mean, you mentioned the no-till movement and some of the innovative strategies that farmers have used, and that technology and practices are important. But it was interesting to me that you also brought out the need for a new reliance or a new interest in perhaps some of the Indigenous knowledge that we have, and both Indigenous knowledge and culture. And I just wondered if you could explain how that can help us position for the future.
Yes, you know, I will say that the Indigenous focus was not part of our mandate that we were originally given with the question we were asked about plant health. But as we began to think about it, we realized, of course, that for thousands of years, the Indigenous people of Canada have lived on the land, with the land, and their view of the environment is, they talk about kincentricity or kincentric ecology, where they are part of the ecosystem. And of course, that's a very valuable way of thinking about and understanding our place in taking care of our environment. And so I think we can learn from that. And of course, their traditional knowledge of their homelands tells us a lot about, they can talk a lot about how that environment has changed over time, over many, many generations through their shared knowledge. And they have a tradition of living with and using the plants that are on that landscape. So we think we can learn from that. I think it's an important piece. And when we think about plant health, one of the issues, of course, is from our own perspective, it's about food and food security. And we recognize that Indigenous people have a right to their traditional foods and lands and to food security. And as part of Canada's commitment to reconciliation, we think this is something that as a nation we should pay attention to going forward.
It's also something that, that perspective, I think, adds a real new element to our thinking process, which tends to be, I think, in our culture would tend to be fairly linear. Whereas if you consider yourself part of an ecosystem, you're responding to a whole bunch of different effects and responding accordingly.
Yes, absolutely. And of course, it's a piece of the long time scale, I think, where that Indigenous seven generations perspective is something that we can benefit from, particularly as we think about, another main focus of our report, which of course was Canada's forests and the forest industry. And, when I think about Canada, I feel that as a nation, we're truly blessed with the land, the water, the ecosystems we have, and to be able to have such economically vibrant and important industries, which, as you said at the beginning, we can actually use those towards mitigating and managing climate change. So I think this is a very positive thing. And I hope that our report will be seen as a positive contribution to people understanding those complexities and the opportunities, and that we're building on a wonderful foundation of investment in plant breeding, in agricultural systems, in farming, in education for farmers and those who work on the land. And, this is an incredible gift that we as Canadians enjoy.
Dr. Buzzard, thank you very much for joining me today.
It's been my pleasure, Laura. Thank you for the opportunity to talk about our report. As I say, I hope it will be useful to the community.
That was University of British Columbia Professor Dr. Deborah Buzzard in conversation with Glacier Farm Media's Laura Rantz here on Between the Rows. If you'd like to read the report from Dr. Buzzard and her panel, you'll be able to find it online at cca-reports.ca. That's our time for the week. We'll be back in 7 days with more from the Glacier Farm Media family of publications. One more thing on the cheerful topic of threats to Canadian agriculture. Glacier Farm Media has a webinar coming up on February 17th at 10 a.m. Central Time that you'll definitely want to check out. It's Cybersecurity and Your Farm Business, Part 2. We're hosting it in partnership with the Community Safety Knowledge Alliance and Public Safety Canada. It'll feature Dr. Janos Botchner, who you've heard here on the show a couple of times in the past few months, along with Ritesh Kotak and Lenore Newman. Of course, this is a new front in farm and agri-food security, and they'll be talking about the areas where government and industry are going to need to support farmers. Now, for the webinar, the price is definitely right. It's free. And to register in advance, you can go to eventbrite.com, then search up Glacier Farm Media. You've been listening to Between the Rows. I've been your host this week, Dave Bedard. Thanks for listening.
I've been farming my whole life, and the one thing you can always count on is change. And now there's a new generation of inoculants from Lalemann Plant Care. New engineered granules in Lalfix Spherical for pulses and soybeans that provide improved handling and accurate metering. New Rhizobium and Lalfix Pro Yield that deliver improved nitrogen fixation and iron uptake in soybeans. I've seen a lot of change, but this Lalemann company, well, this changes everything. Contact your Lalemann sales representative today.